When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, we have a special guest on Lulz today. It is Elihu Foystel. He is the author of a new book, Beyond the Odds, Efficient Market Theory and Tools of Warfare for the Modern Sports Bettor. Many of the topics he writes about are right in our wheelhouse, things we've discussed here on Lulz. So excited to dig deeper into topics about the sports book versus the players, the recent DraftKings issues, and all kinds of other stuff under that umbrella. I'm Pete with Brick. This is Lulz. Let's do it.
He thinks this is a go. Vegas Dave thinks this is a go.
Hot naked girls doing yoga.
What?
Why don't you just win like a man?
Random.org. Type in one for yes, two for no, and let the DFS cats pick for you.
And I'm absolutely begging you not to dupe us. Please don't dupe us.
Let me get my guests on stage here. There we go. Elihu, welcome to Lulz. Excited to have you, man.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.
Brian, what? Tell me, because you introduced me to Elihu's work previously. Where did he first come across your radar?
He would be. So I have kind of two or three installments of sports writers. So my first ones, my age, people will probably remember. The blackjack writer. So Kenny Uston, I loved Kenny Uston's book. I liked Blackjack Attack by Don Schlesinger. And that was kind of my entryway into gambling books. And so I don't know, people, the youngsters probably don't know, but like Barnes and Noble's back in the day had a gambling section. You'd see all the, the 2+2 books, right? They'd be sticking out. You already had all those. Then there was like blackjack section. And then from there, I moved on to much later on, his first book I read was Conquering Risk, I think. I have the hard copy somewhere. And that was when I first started like getting down into the spreadsheet stuff. Before that, I was a poker player. Funny enough, we have Taylor Cabey on next week. He's another one of the guys who I've learned a lot from in my gambling venture. But yeah, that, and so sports betting, I kind of gave up on it after about 6 months in like 2011 ish, after putting in quite a bit of time into it. I don't know why. I can't remember that far back, but the good thing was a lot of the work I did led into DFS. And so I started playing DFS maybe 3 years later, seriously, and then that became my job. And so part of that reason is because of you. So that's, I appreciate it, and thanks for coming on.
Hey, yeah, flashback. The first gambling book I ever read, again, I got at Barnes & Noble, was Blackjack for Blood, but I think it was Bryce Carlson, which was the beginning that took me from being a trial lawyer to drifting into other areas.
I never read that one, and that's pretty rare for me not to have read one of those blackjack books back then. I had a lot of them.
So most of the other books had simple high-low strategy, you know, plus one, minus one count. Mm-hmm. Bryce had a level two count. So some cards were plus one, some are plus two, minus one, minus two. And what he did differently from everyone else is the aces, he didn't track them in the count, but used a side count for betting. So he gave you a better count for how to play and a better count for how to bet. So it was really good on double deck games, whereas high low is pretty good for the six deck. But I don't know if we're getting too much in a tangent.
I got to talk about this. Yeah, because I was bringing, so Kenny Uston had three points. This is so long ago. This is a guy like 20 years ago. And he would count aces with his foot. Do you remember this? Like one, two, you know, you just direct your feet and you leave it in that place, and that's how you can count aces. And Schlesinger in his Blackjack Attack, he did like just some matrice of what, oh God, I think it was aces, but some specific things you needed to remember. And like 10% of them made up 80% of the outcomes. So it's like, just remember these rules for
the
sure.
18 for the adjustments. Yeah.
Okay. There you go. Yeah. No, yeah. I'm sorry, Pete. We're geeking out here.
No, I love it. I was around one of my first introductions pre-poker too, was again, not quite as in the weeds as you guys were, but Bringing Down the House, the book about the six MIT yeah. students. Like, that was what got me really excited and jazzed up about the world of advantage play and gambling as well. So it seems like blackjack is a gateway drug for everyone.
Yeah. And people who learn blackjack tend to learn risk management really well. That's, you know, the most critical thing in blackjack is knowing how much to bet relative to your bankroll and not overbetting it. And so many poker players, I think, are terrible at risk management. And sports bettors are just in general bad, but not as bad as poker players. But the blackjack, the guys who win at blackjack, they understand risk management. So I like working with guys who have already done blackjack in the past.
How do you, like, if you're going to define risk management, I know a lot of people in our circle with DFS and best ball will talk about bankroll management. How is risk management different than that?
Yeah, that's the same. It's whatever your bankroll is, you're not betting more than you should. That's the core of risk management. So in blackjack, it's pretty easy because one, you know pretty close to what your edge is. It's a lot harder to know what your edge is in sports betting or in draft, fantasy draft.
Yep. And what, how did you, because I know you're, are you still a practicing lawyer? Like, what came first, your sports betting and advantage play or being a lawyer?
I started law. I graduated from law school in 95 and I practiced law for 9 years. I still have a law degree and it's active. I haven't thrown it away yet, but I don't do, and it's actually surprisingly useful in sports betting, looking at TNC and finding ways to avoid problems. It's Ooh. Not very helpful with gaming commissions because they tend to ignore the rules.
That is, and it I know a lot too of kind of like what you're talking about, and Brian and I have touched on this a little bit, like the morality of some of the issues around this game of cat and mouse between the sports bettor and yeah. the sports book, and like where is that moral gray area? And it sounds like you might have a different perspective because of your legal background on some of that.
Well, I don't look at it from a framework of morality so much as a legal framework. If you're, you know, there are some laws that aren't moral, and there are some actions you can take that are immoral that happen to be legal. So rather than look at it from a right or wrong, I just look at it from a criminal law and a contract law framework.
Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. That makes it easy on you.
Well, I mean, yes, it does.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, I mean, I think there's, you know, also, you know, what you ought to do, right? Should, you know, is I think could be taken into account. Like, yeah, maybe I can use all the coupons at this company to make $5,000 back. But ought I do that? Probably not.
Well, what they should do is take a bet and you should just beat them and take their money. That's how, or lose to them like most people do.
That's why this is so interesting of a morality discussion. I know maybe, and we don't have to talk about it. We could talk about law only if you want, but I think that's what makes it so interesting. And it's not just their behavior. It's their behavior in context of the government and limiting other, making barriers to entry for competitors who would not limit you possibly, but they can't because yes. their margins are low. And so burying the lead here, I think it's probably morally, if I could use that word, probably okay because of their behavior. But I'm still not entirely sure, but let's say those barriers weren't there. They weren't using the government to protect themselves. They let people bet some sort of reasonable limit. Then I would say quite clearly, no, it's probably not. You shouldn't do that. Like, you shouldn't behave that way.
Let's define your framework for morality. Okay. What makes, before you say this is moral or immoral, what makes an action or inaction moral in your viewpoint? You know, it's one framework might be do what is good for everyone. Another framework might be do what is good for my profit. What is the framework you want to use when you're analyzing morality?
Oh, God. I mean, this is going to get deep, but I would have supposed to do something. I mean, probably private property rights. So it's their property. I don't have a right to someone else's property. It's their business. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't want something like that done to me. so I won't do it to them. But yeah, morality gets really deep. Like we're getting into like Jonathan Haidt here and stuff like that. And
not even 10 minutes into the show, this is what we do.
Yeah. But like then you get it, you know, you get into some stuff, like you really can't define morality and stuff. And like a lot of it's due to evolution, right? And the reasons we behave in a tribe. And then I have these feelings because of this stuff. I don't really want to talk about that. Like clearly taking stuff from a business is, I think the vast majority of people would say, reasonable people would say that's wrong.
So you just described several different ways to evaluate it. For when I'm thinking about morality, am I the most important thing? Is my family the most important thing? Is my tribe the most important thing? Is my country the most important thing? Or is the species as a whole? So you can weigh it however you want. And if it's just your tribe or your family, it's very easy to justify a lot of things. If you're trying to create a profitable society where everyone has a chance, then you may have a different value set.
And just to frame this for people, because I know we kind of like jumped ahead, where I was piggybacking off of was this idea of basically what sports bettors can do in that game of cat and mouse. And maybe specifically we could frame it through the lens of bearding or multi-accounting.
Okay. Back to the law.
Okay.
Let's do it. Take us back to the law.
Well, most of the contracts are going to say you have to be the controller of the account and only one account per person. So the first question is, if you went to court on that contract, would that be a reasonable contract? If I open two accounts and then they wouldn't pay me on one, and I sued the sports book for not paying me on the second account, their lawyers would raise a defense. You breached the contract. This is a critical term. You breached it. Therefore, we don't owe you. And a court would probably uphold that. Now, another perspective might be from a criminal prosecution. You know, court of, is it fraud? The elements for a fraud are you have to have a misrepresentation, a reliance on that misrepresentation, and a harm caused by that reliance. So in the sports books, criminal prosecution against a bearder, the bearder represented that he only has one account and that this is not a new account. The sports book relied on that to either give him more bonuses or to give him regular limits when they'd already made a business decision to cut it. And as a result of that misrepresentation, they either lost more money in bonuses or lost more money to his wagering. So in that context, it's a pretty slam dunk case of criminal fraud. So from a legal perspective, you're on treacherous ground if someone ever decides to go after that. And we've seen that happen in Australia. There was a guy who he actually opened over 1,000 accounts. And I think he went to jail for 5 or 6 years for it.
I didn't hear that one. It doesn't surprise me with Australia.
What do you, because it does seem like you view it maybe differently from some other sports bettors, like listening to you kind of talk about it with Rufus. Do you feel like you're playing this game almost with one hand tied behind your back if you are, you know, more playing by the rules, knowing that these other sports bettors are gaming it in a way?
Not really. There's so many different ways to win money. And, you know, the low hanging fruit is just bonusing or abusing Cambi that has just bad lines. And, you know, yes, you can create multiple accounts, but there's so many different ways to win. It's just, how hard do you want to work to make your money? That's the only question. How much do you want to make and how hard do you want to work? It's not really a handicap to not be able to bet into multiple legal accounts. It's one set of options doesn't exist, but there's lots of other ways to win.
Is the getting down the hardest, do you think? I mean, Spanky always says that.
It depends on how much you want to bet. If you're obviously the more you want to bet, the harder it is. The earlier you want to bet, the harder it is. And the softer the book you want to beat, the harder it is. If you don't mind betting late into mature markets and big books, it's not hard. But it's more difficult to generate winners against that line set also.
The sports betting kind of industry, for me and Pete talk about this every now and again, doing content like this, you know, besides podcasts for sports betting is kind of boring and no one really does it well. This adversarial relationship between And please don't make me like define what adversarial means in this adversarial relationship between sports better and the books also makes it like, well, I don't want to like, you know, give player props that I can from DFS because you're going to get limited anyways. So, you know, or like I give you out a prop and then the first guy gets it and then the line goes, okay, can we work together? Like that seems like a pain in the ass. Now I got to trust you with my money. Just like from every angle from a poker player or DFS player where we have this peer-to-peer world, it's like kind of, you know, I don't know, you know, boring. I don't know what the word is. Like, I'll, you know, maybe you could talk about, have you thought anything like similar to that?
I guess the sports betting is very different from poker playing. The winners, the people who win in sports in general are very reputable. The people who win consistently and do partnerships with other people, they do so because they have good reputations. They don't stiff people. So it's very rare to hear of a major winning player who acts dishonorably because your reputation is so critical. I mean, in poker, if you stiff someone, you can borrow money and get back in the game. In sports, if you have a reputation for being a liar, everyone knows it, and your best relationships can't exist then. The ability to bet large or to bet into various outs will be stifled if you have a reputation for dishonesty.
What about content-wise? Like, do you see any fun content?
Twitter's entertaining sometimes. It would be extraordinarily hard to do a podcast every week with good original content. So you can only hit serious stuff so much. You can hit new news so much. Like the DraftKings plan to cover up the mistake they made several years ago in agreeing to a 51% tax rate in New York. But, you know, how many new events happen that are interesting and can keep people watching a podcast for an hour?
Yeah. And we talk about that a lot. Like there's really good educational content, yourself included, the guys over at Unabated. We've had Captain Jack on do a lot of good stuff, teaching people how to fish. And then there's that other side of the coin where you have the touts and you have the packages and you have the wild promises and the marketing aspects. And it's like, how do you view that arm of the sports betting ecosystem? Because it is pulling in new people, like it is keeping the industry afloat. And yet there are some shady practices there.
Well, and that goes back to vices, you know, gambling's a vice, but you're free to do it. People who use touts probably have no expectation to win, but they probably enjoy the process. So most touts are not going to increase your odds of winning, but they may increase your engagement. You may actually enjoy it more. I'm not really sure though. I don't use touts. I wouldn't expect to make money from them, but I wouldn't necessarily say they're evil. I mean, how many people who follow a tout actually expect a guy to hit 80%?
You read the mentions, it seems like a lot.
Well,
it's always surprising.
Yeah. Then, you know, our math has failed us in elementary school, I guess.
Yeah.
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 Go ahead.
No. It's like this, the people they attract are often the people that aren't going to understand those things like probabilities. And they're almost selling them this false hope of what's realistic.
Well, these same players are going to lose no matter what they do. Does it matter if they lose it to the sports book or to the touts?
Yeah.
So,
that's true. I suppose. Yeah. What's your thought on like I define gambling or at least part of it as an entertainment product. Do you agree with that?
It can be a different things to different people. So, or
I'm asking you.
Well, what I do isn't, I don't gamble, so I don't know. What I do isn't gambling.
For most, so you're saying you have such an edge, you're just basically not going to lose.
There's no risk of losing if I hit the long term and don't overbet. It's, you know, it doesn't take much of an edge to get to a long term point where you're going to win.
Yeah, like I lose with movies. I never win. I always lose. I always pay. Right. Like I lose money overall, but I like it. It's entertaining and I'm still do it. Like, so
you lose money with movies, did you say?
Yeah. Cause you have to pay an entry fee.
Okay. Oh, sure. And that's entertaining. And if there's some people who probably gamble for entertainment, if having $10 in a game makes it that much more interesting to you and you paid 50 cents for that entertainment, that's not a bad deal.
What else could it be besides entertainment?
It could be a problem if you are betting with the expectation of winning and you don't have a reason to have that expectation.
Sure. Every hobby could become a problem, right? Like people hoard Legos and shit.
Yeah. You didn't see my Lego closet. So,
well, how do you, because to Brian's point though, right? Like if every single person in the sports betting space was like you and they say, I don't do this for entertainment. I'm not gambling. Like this is, I'm extracting money. Like the ecosystem couldn't exist, right? Like it does need people participating within an entertainment framework for it to exist at all.
Or a degenerate framework. More importantly, I think the degenerates probably contribute a lot more than the entertainment people. But yes, you are correct.
I still think it's entertainment either way. So like, let's use the movies. Like I can make money at movies. Like maybe I sell them. Maybe I work in the industry. I could lose money by paying for the products. I could have a problem, get an addiction with it and buy tons of movies. So I'm the,
is this where we hear about your porn addiction, Brian?
my naked yoga addiction. So it's just entertainment though.
But still entertainment. The human brain does not respond to movies or Legos the same way that it responds to cocaine or heroin. You get a much higher dopamine rush. You have an addictive response. And in many ways, those who are deep into sports betting have the same addictive behaviors with sports betting that you see in drug addiction. Whereas let me finish this a little bit.
You don't get the same
addictive response in most hobbies. So in some ways, I would say, sports betting is much more at risk for people than movies or other hobbies. And it is a vice that is similar to drug use for those who consume it.
Well, let's say it's the highest. I'll just grant it's the highest. It's still entertainment.
It's voluntary taxation, which means it's state sponsored.
Well, no, you can make money.
You can, but not collectively. As a whole,
what industries collectively?
What's that?
How does that work collectively in any industry?
Yes, you can make money, but it's a negative sum game.
So is the
money is being pulled out to the sports book movies being pulled out to taxes. So money
so is everything.
Money out.
I'm gaining entertainment from the movie product, but it's still negative sum for me.
Yes, but it's how negative is it relative to the payoff?
Let's say it's the most negative. It's still entertainment.
Okay, well, I'd have trouble rating movies as negatively as, morphine addiction.
Okay, let's say they're least negative. It's still entertainment.
Okay. Life is short. You have to enjoy life. The question is, how much do you pay for your vices?
Sure, it's still entertainment, though.
Yeah. I mean, I like pizza, but if I ate a pizza every day, I'd be...
That's true, yeah.
I don't think we're getting anywhere with this. So someone in the chat wanted to get your thoughts on a book's ability to limit winning players. Obviously a classic kind of conversation with that spins off from this dynamic.
Well, legally they have a right to do it. I think it's lame because you can run a business well without having to limit players. The marketing books, they do this to cut expenses. This way they don't have to spend as much on math. They don't have to spend as much on research. They don't have to manage their company as well by branding themselves just an entertainment product instead of an economic product. So yeah, it's legal. I think it's lame. And I don't like books that limit people. It's a very frustrating experience for those that win or even those that lose to get limited.
But that's kind of goes back to your thing too of then, so people say like, no, I completely agree with it. And that's why if they're going to play this game, then I have to play the game and get someone else to make an account. And you're saying like, I realize this is frustrating, but I'm just not going to break the terms and conditions, basically.
I'm not going to create a second account in part because I think the potential consequences are too high. You know, when I drive, I speed. I always go at least, 5-8 miles an hour over the limit because I don't see many consequences of that, of violating that law. The downside of if you break their law and you beat them out of 100,000, or however much you beat them out of, a likely consequence is they're not going to pay you. So you spend all this time to not generate any income. And a less likely response, although I think this is increasing, is that there could actually be a criminal prosecution against you.
Have you heard any horror stories of that happening to people who've done that?
There's only been a couple cases in the U.S., and it's always been when there's another accompanying crime. So a person who stole 20 debit cards and opened up 20 accounts from his basement, he got charged with all the stuff, but if he hadn't done these other things, he wouldn't be charged. And it's the same way with, you can be charged with illegal sports betting. But the only people who have ever heard of being charged with illegal betting are the ones who stole a check to fund it or did some other more serious accompanying crime. But I think in the future, the amount of damage players are doing to the legals is so high through multi-accounting, they may change that balance. Right now, if a DraftKings or Bet Rivers or Cambie brought a prosecution against a player, it would be a lot of bad PR, potentially. But the amount that they're losing to this type of stuff is so high, they may have to change the way they're responding.
We had Profit X on the betting exchange here in the States. I'm not sure if you're familiar there. I guess they're going what do you say, 40 states or something like that, Pete?
It was a good show, yeah.
And it's peer-to-peer, and their angle is they're going under the sweepstakes model in these states for peer-to-peer betting. If you don't know a lot about it, you don't have to answer, but what is your take on their chances of success through that angle, and then peer-to-peer books in general?
So there's two different issues. The first would be the legal angle. I don't know if a betting exchange can properly fall under a fantasy draft rule set. I don't know that. So I'm going to skip that. The other thing is, from a business perspective, is an exchange, any type of betting exchange, likely to succeed in the US? And for the next few years, I think that's unlikely. I think most players aren't sophisticated enough to appreciate what they're gaining from an exchange. And the liquidity isn't high enough probably to get the higher level players involved.
We talked about this with him as well. In my head, and I think this is how it works at Betfair, it's kind of like the poker head-to-head lobbies. Like, eventually it's an end game boss, and you got the five best players who sit all the tables. And it's like, yeah, the rake's lower, but it's still kind of you're playing against the best players in the world. It's not really, me and the guy two streets over both are playing, want to bet the Bears,
Yeah, when you get the ultra-liquid places, yes. Then the exchanges just become a way, again, to take money from the fish and feed the sharks. It just takes a while. And the exchanges are actually incentivized to prevent the sharks from eating all the fish. Because the exchanges make their money when money circulates. It goes here. It goes. The best thing would be if you two were just going back and forth and they're earning their commission each time.
Yeah.
The problem is if the shark is taking out 10% of the money with each exchange, he's taking out money a lot faster than they're earning a commission, and the money gets sucked out. When the money's sucked out, it's not bouncing back and forth earning commission. So when you're running an exchange, you have to either accept that or more likely with Betfair, for example, they have a premium charge that increases the more you take out, the more you take out relative to the commissions you pay. But I've heard horror stories of people who've just been gouged by it, in some cases unfairly, where they... Anyway, that's a story for another day, though.
Well, I have an idea that I told him, which he didn't seem to like very much. I love the Zoom poker model where you get randomly assigned a seat and then you switch after every hand. And I want this in DFS, but I feel like in peer-to-peer it could happen too somehow. Like, you just put up a line, Bears, Rams, this +4, -4, no vig or anything. And then you bet on a side. And you get entered in a pool, and then you get matched up with a peer on the other side. And then forget the line. You just we're going to charge 2% or whatever their commission is.
So this is just for entertainment. And that might work for people if you could educate them on it, convince them to do it.
No, I mean, they're gambling still.
They're gambling, but yes, they're gambling. But the people who do this to actually make money would probably be a lot less interested in that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I don't think you could get the liquidity either. I'm just trying to brainstorm like ideas that make it so it actually is peer to peer. And if like, so like, let's say you bet 100,000 on the Bears plus eight, and then me and Peter donkeys, we bet the Rams minus eight, you know, there's no VIG. We bet $50 each. Well, that gets entered in a random pool, let's say. And then even donkeys who are on your side, you might not get our 50. Like it's just randomly assigned and matched up. And so like they might put 100,000, they might want to be able to get 100,000 down, but they probably still, based on just like the liquidity factor that they have 100,000 down, that they get most of it anyways, even in the random matching. But I don't know, something like that could possibly fix it. But like, I mean, sports betting really is, it's like these conglomerates, you know, you know, and then you got the like middle tier who kind of guys who are reading your books and, you know, putting a little effort into it, maybe making a little money, maybe losing a little money. And then this new kind of like prop hunter thing that's in our world of, because the DFS guys are already doing props already. They've been doing it for years. And then so people can kind of make money like that, but you get limited so fast doing that.
Yeah. I gave up on props a long time ago just because it was hard to get and keep liquidity.
Yeah, I believe it. Yeah.
But go ahead. That was a big thing for me when I started, though. It's the some of the edges on props, especially if you're, you know, first to bite on it, it can be just crazy.
Would you say now, because like obviously you have, if you think about the progressions of how do you get to, you know, making a book of, you know, you're looking into the math behind this, you're finding your edges, and then there's the actual sports betting itself, putting it in practice, yada, yada. And now you're getting to the point where you're teaching and you're making content around it. Are you at the stage with all of this stuff where the content, the teaching, the books is what is most, you know, invigorating for you?
The problem solving is still the most interesting thing to me.
Okay.
Solving an issue, whether it's the value of moving the kickoff return point 4 yards ahead on a game total, or whatever problem you have. Yeah, things are changing, and finding answers and then executing the answers, putting that new answer into practice. So once you have it, the execution working, then it becomes boring. But when you have an idea and you have a solution and you're trying to find a way to turn that solution into money, that process before you get to the end is fun.
Yep. And people always ask the question too, like, well, if you have this big edge, if you have all the secrets, why share them? Why give them away for free?
Most of my edges aren't that big, first of all. Second, edges are always going away. Anything I'm doing is going to be gone in a couple of years. It took me 3 years to write this book. A lot of the stuff that I wrote about is already diminishing. So some people like to hold tight to their small edges and hope they never go away. I find that giving stuff away and talking to other people and exchanging ideas, I gain a lot more than I lose.
I agree with that 100%. When I was, this is the reason we're doing this show right now. When I was doing poker, I was very isolated. I wouldn't talk, you know, I wouldn't talk strategy with anyone. I was in no clicks. Seems like you wanted to say something there. Yeah. No, and so, and so once I got into DFS and started being successful and noticing people saying my screen name and stuff in chats and stuff, I decided like specifically to be more public and do a podcast and it hurt, you know, because some of the ideas I have definitely have been used by content sites, like for sure, and they probably otherwise wouldn't have, or taken a little longer maybe, but. Like I am friends with Pete and a whole bunch of other guys now in the industry, which is fun. I get to do podcasts, which I enjoy. I started a business with other DFS players who they probably wouldn't even know who the hell I was, you know, or like they wouldn't trust me because they didn't see my podcast, you know, maybe. And it has all these benefits. And like, I've always wanted to write a gambling book too. You know, like you, cause just for the nostalgia of that Barnes and Noble, you know, the, shelf, and you know, you can't, it's, you could do that, but if no one knows who you are, like, you're probably not going to buy it, you know, like especially these days. So there's tons of benefits to that. People, they just go, oh, you're giving away your edge, you must suck or whatever. And it's like, there's a little more to it.
Well, just, you know, take a moment and think long term When I published Conquering Risk 14 years ago, that turned out to be a fantastic move because I ended up meeting so many people. Lots of people wrote me, asked me questions, and it actually steered my path for many years after that.
You took a lot of, so this is, I remember in the what, 2010-ish or whatever, was it the RX forum, one of the sports betting forums, and I was reading, there was a lot of mean comments towards you, and I'm like, what are you talking about? You know, like, were they like, it seems like sports bettors, like, they have like
they're very cranky.
They're very cranky. Thank you, Pete. Like, on Twitter or in the forums, they do not like people giving away edges, you know. And I don't know, it seems to me like you, you know, before I even followed you on Twitter a long time ago, you were taking a lot of shit in the forums.
Well, I said a lot of stupid things then too. I say fewer stupid things now, but a lot of it was probably deserved. So I'll just leave it at that.
Okay. Wow. Fair enough.
The, who do you think your book's like target demo is? Like, who, you know, obviously I think there's a nice scope to it, but like, who is the type of person that this book was made for?
Well, in the introduction, I say it's for people who already win. Now, people who don't win can learn from it, but the idea is it's aimed at someone who already has a good modeling framework or a good setup. And how do you go from where you are now to leveraging and making more and making good decisions long term? You know, looking at models, understanding risk, identifying markets. So it's very different. The first book from 14 years ago, my goal was to write at a seventh grade level to teach people the basics that they need to win at sports. And this one's a more challenging theoretical level, although there's a lot less math.
Yeah.
Do you think that's why I the first book.
What?
I said that's why I understood it. I understood the first book because it's seventh grade.
Did you have trouble with this book?
Big words, yeah. Go ahead, Pete. You were going to say something.
No, I was just going to say, do you think that's – because that feels like a very narrow scope for a demographic because we already know there's so few winning sports betting players. And then the ones that are, what percentage of those have sophisticated models that they've already beat? So, like, that's kind of a tight needle to thread.
Yeah, and you're right, it is. And I said, I'm going to write the book the way I want to write it. And I said, I'm not going to – it's what I want to do. And I wrote the book I wanted to write. There were other decisions in there with some of the verbiage I used or some of the content that people told me I should take out. Like, you know, my estimate of money levels for different levels of players or some of the actual specific facts I included in there. It was like, nope, this is my book and I'm just going to do it the way I want.
So the book's Beyond the Odds. We have the link, right, Pete, in the notes. I wanted to say, like, I think – hopefully you get some attention here because a lot of DFS guys want those little models and Excel sheets that even sports bettors have that aren't directly useful, but that can be manipulated to be useful.
Right.
And you can see on page 37, at least the digital copy, you have a link to, it says 30 code examples of Excel and Pascal. So if anyone is interested in actual code, he's got 30 examples there.
Yeah. And that was another thing I wanted to do differently, which was include a whole bunch of stuff that people could work through themselves. So I hadn't seen it, but originally I was just going to give a file name of a Google sheet, but the QRC code made it a ton easier than having someone reading it, trying to type in a 40 character length name.
Yeah. And so it does. What it kind of makes me think, and I'm not equating it specifically, but did you have thoughts on the Billy Walters book? He also had like a chapter where it was like, you know, less breaking from the narrative. And then like, this is my process. Like, this is what we were doing to be a profitable sports bettor. Did you have thoughts on that?
I actually didn't read his book.
Okay.
I heard some of the things about the conversions he was using, and then I just didn't bother reading it.
Yet that it put you off as if it like wasn't interesting or relevant for you?
I think some of the push rates he used were just absurd. So I don't know all. I mean, I'm sure he did a lot of good things, but his approach is very different from mine.
Yeah.
So I think their approach was bet as much as you can on the edges you have. And I mean, how many times, I don't know how many times he went bust or over bet to such a degree that he had anxiety. But those are, you know, execution issues that I don't understand why a person would do.
Yeah. Hmm.
The interview I saw with him on Rogan, I think it was, too, he was also saying, like, stuff we, you know, you clearly don't know, you know, like, I can't remember what they were, Pete. Something like, you know, like that betting moves the markets, not sharp betting or something like that. Like, yeah, just like obvious 101 stuff. And like, was he trying to dumb it down for the audience? I don't know. It was very strange. Yeah.
Yeah. Did you go to Bet Bash, the recent big sports betting event? Okay. What is that like? I'll see some of the photos pop up on Twitter, you know, Spanky in his tux. Like, is that kind of an extension of, you know, the dynamic we were just talking about where like you put yourself out there and now you meet this network of people and it kind of takes this solitary thing and turns it into a communal experience?
It was fascinating. It's actually the third time I've gone to Bet Bash, and there are some very smart people there, some very honorable people there, some scumbags there. It's, you have the whole gambling community there, like a lot of the big hitters there. There was, inducted in the Hall of Fame, Jimmy Everett, who was head of Pinnacle and the computer group with Billy Walters a long time ago. He's actually the person who got me to walk away from my law job and go into sports betting. So it was a blast from the past seeing him after 20 years. But yeah, there are all sorts of people. They have a speed networking, which if you work hard to describe what it is you want and what skills you have, is very good at matching you up to different kinds of people. So I was looking for modelers, movers, and I found some very smart modelers who are attacking the problem. The new thing to do now is trying to come up with a way to win at post so that it's harder to clock a player. It's hard to rate how smart he is if he's betting at post. So that's a new generation, and lots of people are doing that. And there's quite a few people who are specializing that on that that I met at Bet Bash.
And when you say post for people, you mean a lot of the typical value in sports betting is you get in early while the line is efficient, and it's much harder to beat a closing line number. And so when you say post, do you mean the closing line number?
Yeah. So post is when the match starts. So yeah, general, if a person bets more than 6 hours before the match starts, it's pretty easy to beat. If they bet on overnights the night before, it's, if you have a good model, that's the best, but the limits are going to be very low compared to how much you can bet. If you bet at the last half hour, the last hour, not only are limits going to be highest, but when a book looks at that wager, they're going to be much more tolerant of you winning because they're going to think you're lucky more than you're smart. You know, if you bet on an overnight, you bet the Cowboys -6, and on game day, it moves to -7. Now you've picked up probably 5% value going from 6 to 7. And that book says, oh my God, that wager's clocked at +5%. And if all your wagers are being clocked at above, 1.5-2%, a book's going to be terrified of you. Whereas the new generation of modelers are saying, if I can come in the last 60 minutes and the closing line is wrong, I'm going to bet into a wrong close. And maybe I'm only going to make, I'll hold 3-4%. Whereas that wager at -6 closing at 7, you may have an 8-10% edge. Maybe NFL is a bad example, but in college sports, it's not uncommon to get 8% edges when you're betting into overnights. So instead of going for the giant edge, the diamond, you're going for lots of coal. You go for a much smaller edge and a lot higher volume, but then the regulated books have a lot more trouble determining how smart you are. So they can't, some people can get kicked out in just 2 bets. You make 2 bets, you bet the Dallas -6, it closes at -7, you bet it happens twice, the book says, nope, no mas. Whereas if you're betting and you're winning with an edge, but it's not as obvious, you can last a lot longer.
I was going to ask you about that as far as like their detection. And I know you have some experience behind the scenes on that too, where I've always heard people say that, like, you mix in, throw in some parlays, throw in some spread bets to throw them off the scent. Like, aren't these systems like sophisticated to be like their bets are very polarized? It's either like really fishy stuff intentionally, or they are betting 24 hours ahead on an overnight thing. Like, can't the system detect that and be like, this is still an account we're going to flag because we can tell what you're doing?
Yeah. Well, ask your degenerate friend what he bet in the last week.
Pete, what'd you bet last week?
I only bet for entertainment. Brian.
So when did you bet? What did you bet? How did you bet it? So ask some of your friends who aren't doing this for a living. Get a survey. And you want your bets to look just like theirs. The same sports, the same time placed, the same, if you're using parlays or teasers, whatever it is you're doing, you want to look like them, except maybe you're betting more. And your friends who are betting this stuff and losing, they're not betting overnights. They're not betting soccer or tennis, probably. They're betting, your bread and butter sports. They look at the TV, they see their games on in half an hour, and they're going to bet it. So if you
but can, then what do you say? Because you often will hear from people like the best way, if you want to be a successful sports bettor, go find a niche that is undercovered. Find the Japanese ping pong league, the Australian volleyball. Yeah. But isn't that going to be the thing that flags like, hey, your degenerate buddy isn't betting those things? So like, how do you balance that dynamic? Yeah,
absolutely for US books. But if you are a niche bettor and you bet into the market making offshores, if you're betting into Bookmaker, if you're betting into Pinnacle, if you're betting into Bet Online, you can beat them out of a lot and they'll just let you beat them. They'll use your information to sharpen the number. But if you're beating them, if you're betting openers, they're using that information to get to an efficient price faster. And they're willing to pay you, allow you to win for that information. Whereas the U.S., now contrast that with the U.S. books. Most of the U.S. books are not market makers. They're not trying to find the right price. They're guessing. They're looking to see what the other people are doing, the following. But for the most part, they're not searching for the truth like the market makers. The exception is Circa. Circa is a market maker also. But most of the other books, they're just parasites trying to suck money out of the system and not actually add any information to the marketplace.
Yeah. What
is the, because I think I've maybe asked this to someone before too, but like, why is there such a divide between those two models? Why wouldn't the US books be willing to adopt that kind of offshore model?
There's a much higher cost to use to be a market maker. If you're going to be a market maker, you need much more talented individuals, people who can sniff what's going on in the market. You can see what the other books are offering. You can see what your top players are betting. You're not kicking out the winners. You have to have the winners coming into you and being able to communicate bets to be a market maker. So you're going to have a segment of players that lose, that you lose to. You're going to have higher costs for personnel. You're probably going to need a pretty sophisticated math team. You may need a better software platform to handle this so that you don't get just smashed. So when a smart player abuses a retail book, the retail's response is cut their limits and make them go away. When a smart player abuses a market maker, the market maker looks and they either adapt. They say, how did this guy beat us? He's just destroying us. Let's reverse engineer it. Let's have some math guys look at what he's doing. Let's come up with a better number. So the market makers evolve faster than the retail books. They have to. But the costs are much higher to be able to have that kind of adaptability. Now, on the upside, the market makers have a lot less fraud issues. You don't have people going into market makers trying to create new accounts because of their limits. Now, there are other issues. There may be bonusing, or there might be, trying to circumvent auto move. But it's the incentive to beard into a market maker is much lower than it is the retail books.
Gotcha.
It seems to me, if a company like Bet Online or whatever can afford it, a multi-billion dollar DraftKings company can afford it too. It's just to me it boggles my mind. When you have Dave Portnoy as like your point person, like what a selling point he would have is like, we're the only book in America that doesn't limit people, even though that Circa does it too, but he could lie and just say we're the only one that we take all the sharpest action. And then have like at least a hybrid model where you hire, maybe they spend $20 million on this, they're probably saving that or making it back. And then it's good pub and they don't, to me, it doesn't make any sense.
So some companies might be trying what you're describing. So I think both FanDuel and Circa are trying to move in the sharp direction, but it is very hard to go from being a retail book to being a market maker. If you've already have a lot of your professional players collared, they're not going to give you the information you need. So are you going to uncollar them and then get pummeled? or are you going to start looking for new people? It's it's a daunting task, and I can't imagine how I would try to go from being an existing retail book to an actual market maker.
I have a question. AI question. Over under, let's just say that there's a chance of this, over under of an AI, they, you know, bot or whatever you want to call it, that runs the book for them. And so it's not only a market maker, right? It's expert, you know, sports better. It's taking all the info on the internet. It's making super sharp lines, making sports betting almost unbeatable for everyone. You think, you know, 10 years, 50 years, 100 years, is it possible?
It will never be to the point where it can beat everyone, because there's information sources that you can't get on the internet. But you're already seeing a lot of this. Like, you have bots that are getting Twitter that are grading sentiment. You have this in stocks already, sentiment examiners. You have machine learning that is trying to help make markets, that is looking at competitors' prices and looking at your own players. So it's already moving in that direction. But I think it's a long way before it becomes not worth playing. And we're talking decades, not years.
One of the phrases in the title of your book is efficient market theory. For people who don't know what that topic entails, what can they be expecting with that?
The idea is that when a game starts, the closing line is one of the line you have when the game starts is efficient. That's one of the best measures of what's really going to happen in that game. And the example we gave earlier, we're looking, originally the price was Dallas -6, and by game time, it moved to -7. And if you look at the median outcomes of games, usually that last game is going to be a better measure of what's going to happen. So that's the premise. And there are three different things the book talks about following that premise. The first is using what I call answer key to price derivatives. So if you know the market should be efficient and it should be roughly a 50-50 outcome, there are ways you can use that with sampling to figure out, well, if the Cowboys are -7, what is the fair first half spread, or what's the fair total given this market? And some of the assumptions of efficiency, I'm assuming that it's a 50-50 market, but what happens if in the past it wasn't? What if we were looking at 7-point favorites and somehow these favorites covered 58% of the time? So there are ways you can cheat to make past inefficient markets look efficient. So that's one of the things I talk about in answer key. The second big concept is using efficient markets to say how good are teams or players. Another example of that would be if the Cowboys were 3 points better than the Steelers and the Cowboys are 3 points better than the Texans. If you believe those are two statements of truth, you can infer that the Steelers and the Texans are similar in strength teams on a neutral field. So there's some math on where you can optimize team ratings just using closing, instead of using statistics or scores, use the closing ratings, the closing lines to infer stats. And in many cases, you can get better projections than using actual stats. And the third idea of efficient market theory, again, assuming these closing lines are more, at least as accurate as the results, is a way to evaluate models and to evaluate players based on how they did, not versus results so much as against the closers. Now, when you're evaluating models and players, you look at both closers and you look at win-loss. But if you're looking at under several hundred plays, the closing line theory is much stronger than results. When you get to over a couple thousand plays, I'm much more interested in the actual win-loss, because if you're doing something very original, or if a player is very clever and doing something the rest of the world isn't, that's going to show in his win-loss, but not his closing line value. So was that just a whole mouthful?
No, it's a good explanation of what people can expect in the book there too. How much of, like, do you think the value of what's in the books? Because you mentioned, like, some of the stuff you've been working on it for 3 years, like the goalposts have maybe changed on some of those things. Is it more too of being able to teach you how to fish, to look for the next opportunities, the next edges you're going to need to seek out to actually, you know, consistently win at this?
It's both. So the first answer key right now works, especially strong in football. And it, I think it's fairly hard to execute what I describe. I've tried to walk some people through it, and it's taken several iterations for them to get from theory to actually getting something they can bet. And more people mm-hmm. fail than succeed at it. But the idea of efficient market theory handicapping, that is a tool you can use going forward that I don't think that most people know about. So it can, if you have an existing model now or in the future, you can use that as a different approach to, mm-hmm. you don't use this in isolation, you use it adding to your model. So for example, if I have a model on college basketball totals, and I have my projection based on all my information I have, I can then add the inferred total for this, what this game should be if you believe the closing lines are accurate. So then I have two totals, I can use an ensemble and get a much better number than I could using either one in a vacuum.
Gotcha. Go ahead.
There's actually, OA has a good question for him, but we haven't talked about the gambling tax yet.
I know. Okay. Yeah, we got a lot. Yeah, let's hit on that quickly just to set the table. We talked about this last week, even floated some theories that they might pull this back or walk it back fairly quickly. And then we got news, I believe it was yesterday or 2 days ago, that they are in fact not going to do this. So what was your take on this whole situation, Elihu?
It was a blunder, a marketing blunder. So the idea was DraftKings was going to, four states, DraftKings was going to assess a 3% surcharge on winning wagers. So what that means is if you're betting $110 to win 100, now you're betting $110 to win 97 after the surcharge. So you're raising the average VIG from 110 to about 113.6. And they were hoping, their belief was that the players would be angry and write their legislators, which we know players don't do any kind of thing for anyone. So, and then the second best thing that could happen would be all the other sports books get in line and join them. And that didn't happen. So they're out here threatening to raise the VIG to 113.6. No one's going with them, and the players are angry at DraftKings, not at the regulators. So they pulled back pretty quickly and said, all right, just kidding. But it was caused because they made bad deals. They I think the New York tax is 51% of their revenue, which is insane compared to, I think Las Vegas is about 10%, just as a comparison. Wow. So imagine trying to run a business where over half of your net income is taxed. That's just,
they agreed to that deal because they just thought, we got to get in this state. We need to get the players on our site. And we're willing to make a bad deal to do that.
I think they were just manic. There's no rational explanation for why they would do that.
Yeah. Well, what was the alternative?
Say, sorry, New York, we're not going to bid here because it's too high. And then if all actors were rational, that tax rate would have come down until it was reasonable.
Yeah, maybe. But a competitor would have swooped in and said, we're willing to pay it if we can have the entire market share.
But right now, how many different operators are in New York? It's not just DraftKings. It wasn't. Mm-hmm. So if they had collectively been more responsible, they'd have a lot more money.
Yep.
Yeah. That's never going to happen. What do you think about the idea of adding that tax up front instead of giving less promotions? Maybe the VIG goes up a little bit, you know, et cetera. Like, they got to pay it one way, right?
Right. So what is your alternative to them doing a surcharge on each wagering ticket?
You're asking me?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I don't know. I don't work there, but I'm sure there's hundreds of different ones. They could lay people off. They could, you know, they could raise VIG. Go ahead.
That's what I was saying. Like, what's the difference of that? Because something about the tax just immediately feels jarring to people, as opposed to if your minus 110, 110 bet is now minus 115, 115. Like, if you just folded it in.
If you're dealing, so if you look for Caesars in Canada is dealing a 36 cent line in NFL. So when someone looks to bet NFL on game day and they see they can bet the Cowboys or the Steelers at minus 118, there's a sense of outrage. It's anger because you're used to 110. Mm-hmm. So if it's obviously they're getting screwed, they're not going to like it. So if DraftKings is going to implement a policy to take more money from the players, it has to be invisible, and their approach was anything but. So they could
take it the most visible way. Yeah.
no one understands the math of same game parlay. So that would be a way to do it. You know, you just raise the coalition, the correlation coefficients on anything a person wants to bet, then you're just going to steal a little bit more. But the way they did it was just a bad idea.
Yeah.
Well, I think it was fairly sharp, actually, because I don't think the PR is really that bad. Might even be given more visibility. And I think it was more of a message, you know, to the legislature, like maybe hoping people would start calling and going like, why, what's going on with these taxes, you know, and then maybe have a little more leverage at the capitals. And then they just walk it back a week later. And I think everyone's going to forget about this besides people like us. Most people don't even know that existed, you know? So I don't think it was really I think it might've been kind of sharp.
Okay. Well, we agree on why they did it, just the outcome.
Yeah. It did seem like there was a calculated element to it, right? Like there's this only playing out over the course of a week. And it was like, oh yeah, no, we listened to our customers and now we're done with it. It's like, this. This wasn't like, holy cow, we're shocked. People don't like this tax.
Everyone's talking about this huge tax. Remember people, this huge tax they're doing to us and you. Everyone's talking, but we're listening. We're such good listeners.
I want to people enjoying the streams. Capwise says he's going to buy this book. Have been meaning to. Good nuggets here. This is a good one to kind of wrap us up, as you know, we direct people to check out the book here. OA wants to know, what are some other good sports betting or related books that you recommend, you think are good besides your own, of course?
If you're a beginner, I would start with two other books. And these are older ones. Stanford Wong and Sharp Sports Betting. And Weighing the Odds with King Yao. If you like to bet UFC, the Fightnomics, I think, is a great book. If you want to look into stats and how to really attack it and not just do it recreationally. If you like golf, there's a great book called Every Shot Counts.
Awesome.
And if you that like is, tennis, if you want to really do a deep dive into tennis, Analyzing Wimbledon is great. It's very math heavy. Now, I have a bias. Everything I like tends to have a lot of math in it. So if you don't like math, ignore all my suggestions.
I think people, get the gist. If you're going to put the words efficient market theory in even the subtitle of your book, I think you are priming the readers to know what they're getting into.
And that was another author decision. I could have just gone with the boring Beyond the Odds. I was like, no, I'm gonna spell it out and make people suffer so they know what the kind of pain they're in for.
I know the book hasn't been out too long, but what has the early feedback been? I assume some people at Bet Bash had maybe already gotten their hands on it. Did you get any good reviews?
People generally like it. There's been 9 reviews on Amazon. So it's 1-4, 8-5s. And it's actually sold a lot better than my first book. So
wow.
I'm surprised. You know.
The rate or just the total numbers already?
Both. So, I mean, in 5 weeks, I've sold as many as I did in 2 years at the conference.
Is that Twitter, do you think?
It could be.
Because you didn't have Twitter back then, I don't think.
Correct. Or people may just want to know about warfare and efficient market theory. Who knows?
Yeah.
You're a bigger name.
It is. And I do think it goes back to that, like, community thing, right? Like, imagine Brian, maybe instead of you, when we started Lulz, like, you immediately came out with your in-game syndicate. Like, how would you have done marketing wise versus, you know, 4 years later or whatever it's been, having an audience, building up trust, building up a network, you know, like, that has to have helped you to have been in the game for so long now.
Yeah
That's a good point.
Dinosaur betters, so
I have an Amazon question. So I bought yours on Kindle, and I have the subscription, right? And so it was a freebie.
Yeah.
You get the full value for that, right?
If it's a subscription, I get it based on pages read.
Brian, you better read that whole thing.
But yeah, it's not really quick. And it's less. It's less. It's. I mean, I could actually take a look and see. So let's see. This month, there've been Ken P. Is that the name of your subscription service?
No, that's not me.
Oh, I have royalties, orders, and Ken P, which is some kind of pages read on something.
Weird.
So, I don't know. I bought it, on Amazon Kindle, the digital thing, and it said, you know, free with your subscription.
Okay.
So, I was just wondering, it's like, I've done it a bunch of times over the years. I'm like, I wonder if the author gets screwed by this.
It's so maybe, but I don't care. It's so easy to self-publish on Amazon.
Yeah.
And so you send them a copy with Word, you can get an add-on that saves it in EPUB format. So you turn your Word document, you create an EPUB, you upload it, it's done. And if you upload a PDF with a cover, they print it on demand whenever someone buys a book. So 14 years ago, I used to send these crates of 32 books to whoever wanted to buy it. You know, chunks, that 118 books, I'd send. It was just a pain in the ass. Now, someone orders a book, it prints it and mails it. And it just money drops into my checking account. And that's it.
It's amazing.
It is awesome.
Yeah, Kindle Unlimited. You're always right. Kindle Unlimited is what it was called.
But if you are on something called Kenpie, do not abandon the book. At the very least, even if you want to rage quit the book, quickly tap through and so they think you read every page. So Elephant can get paid accordingly. Yeah. Well, is there anything else? Obviously, I got the link in the description here. We'll have it in the audio show notes for the podcast listeners as well. Anything else you would like them to check out other than your new book?
No, but thanks for having me. It's been fun.
It's fun. Yeah, thanks for coming on.
All right.
Anything else from you, Brian, before we power down here?
No. No. Somebody mentioned how my app's not working on DraftKings. They just updated their table. What's it called? A draft board. So it's coming soon, a fix for that.
CapWise had another book that is actually worth reading, especially for beginner intermediates, which is Logic of Sports Betting. Logic of Sports Betting and also The Interception by Davidow. They have something that kind of inspired me, and I wanted to use what they described, but I thought that would be too plagiaristic. But they talk about a high variance strategy as a way to avoid getting limited. And anyone who is betting heavy would do well to read and understand that at The Interception.
Yeah, that's cool. And I know our buddy Davis Maddock did an interview with Ed Miller when that book came out as well. Well, again, thank you guys in the chat. And thank you again to Elihu for his time. And if you guys want to hear more content, I had listened to his interview with Bet the Process, as well. Have you been making the rounds? Any other, podcast appearances?
I was on a smaller one a couple weeks ago, a Portuguese one.
Oh, really? Wow. Yeah. There you go.
They interview me in English and then they subtext it in Portuguese because there's a really sharp community in Portugal.
That's crazy. Yeah. Never would have known. We're off next week. The week after that, we're going to have Taylor KB from ETR. And then we'll probably be off the following week, Brian, because that's when I head to Vegas on Thursday morning for the beat right before NFL week one.
I knew you were my degenerate friend. See?
So, do you all pause during football season or do you keep recording during the zoo for the next 3 months?
We keep rolling.
We keep
rolling. Yeah. We kind of hang out at the periphery of like actual, football analysis and talk gambling and drama and all of that. So we can always keep going.
And we do no show prep as you are now familiar with and just kind of wing it. So it's not very hard.
All right, guys. Thank you again. We'll see you next time on Lulz. And for Elihu, for Brian, I'm Pete. We'll see you guys next time. Peace.
Mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.